Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Let's start today with our Week in Review. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. We'll start with Mayor Marty Walsh, his first State of the City address and his plan to improve Boston public schools.
I am not satisfied. The Boston public schools can do better for our kids. We have to do better. We will do better.
Also, the debate heats up over Boston's bid to host the 2024 Summer Olympics. The mayor is for it, but opponents say it's a boondoggle in the making, and they're gearing up for a fight.
They come in with a bare-bones plan with very few frills. And once the commitment is made, all of the elaborations and all of the frills come on top of that.
Plus, reactions to demonstrations yesterday that shut down rush hour traffic along I-93.
People are protesting state-sanctioned violence against black people. That's how this movement has begun and why it continues.
And in Washington, Senator Elizabeth Warren sinks a Treasury Department nominee that she said was too close to big business.
For me, this is just one spin of the revolving door too many. Enough is enough.
And joining me now to talk more about these stories and the rest of the week's news is John Carroll. He's a professor of communications at BU and the man behind the Campaign Outsiders blog. Hello, John. Good to have you.
Hello, Anthony.
Also with us is Marcella Garcia. She's an editorial page contributor at the Boston Globe. Marcella, welcome to you as well. Good to have you back.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So let's jump right in to Mayor Marty Walsh's State of the City address. He gave the address from Symphony Hall Tuesday night. He talked about his achievements and priorities for the year ahead. He said his priority would be improving public schools with a longer school day for many schools, a search for a new superintendent. He also focused on race and class and coming to terms with Boston's painful history around busing and race in general. Here's what he said.
I know from my own life, you can't move forward unless you reach out and deal honestly with the past. The truth is that when it comes to race and class, Boston has a lot of unfinished business. We must not be afraid to talk about it.
So, John, he called for a dialogue around race and class, and he's planning to do this with money from a Rockefeller Foundation grant to hire a city resiliency officer. What do you make of this proposal? Can a city conduct a conversation?
I think maybe they can. Now, one of the themes that Mayor Walsh has been hitting on with all the protests in Boston after Ferguson and after Staten Island with Eric Garner has been that there are no specifics there, that he hasn't heard specifically what people want, what they're protesting about. Maybe this officer, whoever it is, whoever comes in and fills that office, will be able to make the conversation a little more specific because it's been pretty vague.
Right. We talked, and Marcella, I'm going to just play this piece of tape before I come to you. We spoke to Joyce Linehan. She's the chief of policy for the city of Boston about what this conversation was really about. And she pointed to the legacy of court-ordered busing. Here's what she said.
I personally used to think that that was a problem with an expiration date. But the older I get and the more you think about it and in talks that I've had with the mayor about this, it really isn't. Even if you weren't here when this stuff happened, even if you weren't born with this stuff happened, when this stuff happened, the baggage is still here. It's this undercurrent that's just always with us.
What do you think, Marcella? Was this were you surprised, impressed, or what was your reaction to the mayor's call on this?
I basically agree with Joyce in the sense that I think Boston still suffers from this image of being racist, and it's been carrying this baggage for a while. I felt it was good that he mentioned it. It was welcome for sure. It's symbolically important to hold a conversation for sure for the brand of the city of Boston. But the truth is that we're at a point that we need to see some policy around this and perhaps what the protest this week brought. They brought a lot of disruptions but they also brought to light some specific proposals that are currently in the legislature that deal with some of the issues that the Black Lives Matter movement want to see addressed, such as police killings of civilians and how to deal with that. And again, their current bills that deal with this, there's one bill I know that establishes an independent panel to investigate any civilian deaths by the police. So it would be good to see the mayor also supporting this type of initiative, not just to stay in the symbolic, although I recognize that that's important too.
Let me ask you both sort of for a general statement about how Mayor Walsh, I thought he looked pretty comfortable there in Symphony Hall delivering his State of the City speech. It's gotten some pretty good reviews. But what stood out to you, John, either from Walsh's first year, what he said the other night, or about the course he set for the year ahead?
Yeah, I think it was a pretty successful cotillion for Mayor Walsh.
It's a good word, cotillion, for what it was. Yeah.
And I think it sort of split into two. And one of them was sort of a high wire act. Looking back at his first year, all his accomplishments are basically within the framework of surpassing Tom Menino. A lot of it was this sort of implicit comparison with Tom Menino. And that was a tricky thing to do. I thought he carried that off pretty well. I mean, one of the things that he's faced criticism for is a kind of a small bore incrementalist approach to Boston and to City Hall over the past year. So I think that, you know, the second part was looking forward and trying to lay out some kind of a blueprint for the future. I think, you know, he's got some interesting things there. I wish that all of these addresses, State of the Union, State of the City, were accompanied by a soundtrack of a cash register going ka-ching every time a proposal comes up. Because, again, yeah, you know, where's the money going to come from? But some interesting ideas.
Always the big question. Marcella, a quick comment from you overall about the mayor's State of the City speech.
I thought it was great. Great ideas, great announcements, a lot of new tech initiatives that were impressive to hear, you know, the mayor talk about. For me, what the thing that stood out was, because perhaps is what's in my mind right now, because I know that that's what it's in the mind of a lot of residents of Boston and parents, the superintendent of the schools. I know we're going to have a new superintendent soon, but he didn't really say anything about teachers of color, about increasing the pipeline of teachers of color, mm-hmm. about the achievement gap between Black and brown and their peers, Asian and whites. So I felt a little, you know, I wished that he would have addressed that in a more concrete way.
All right. Well, let's talk about Boston's bid for the 2024 Olympics, which is going to be a big story for the next 2.5 years. So we're not going to be talking about it every week, I hope. But here we go. There's a lot of initial support for this. A poll out today found 55% in favor, 40% opposed, 5% undecided. For his part, and we'll come back to Mayor Walsh here, he's become the city's biggest booster of the idea. Here he is again in his State of the City address talking about this.
The public process is the ultimate benefit. It's why I'm committed to you that we will hold transparent conversations on every impact in every neighborhood. When we talk about 2024, we'll be talking about what Boston needs today and what Boston needs in 2030, 2040, and 2050.
But there are critics. We spoke to sports economist Andrew Zimbalist, who told us that cities which have hosted the Olympics have had cost overruns and been left with big white elephant facilities. Here's what he said.
It's very hard to make the argument that it was a plus, and in particular the arguments that are being put forward by John Fish and Mayor Walsh promising no new taxes, I think lack credibility based upon other experiences.
So, Marcella, there are the contours of the debate, the mayor on one side, a critic on the other. How do you think this debate is going to play out? And are you comfortable with the promise of openness that the mayor has laid out about this process?
Well, to your initial comment, unfortunately, I think we are going to have five stories in the paper every day from now on until 2017. It just sounds like it's going to be that way. And on the one hand, it's good. But on the other hand, listen, you know, it's. I personally think that there should be a referendum, for example, because we can still not get the bid, and then use this time to talk about these issues. For sure, I don't think it's going to be a completely open process, unfortunately. But having a referendum, whether it's going to be non-binding or what, help public opinion, you know, voice their concerns, and we can still not get it based just on that. And I mm-hmm. think the International Olympic Committee does take into consideration how the city feels about it. And I think a way to move this forward and calm the anxieties a little bit is to put forward the idea of a referendum, because I think that can still happen.
Interesting. What do you think, John? Good idea?
I have no idea. I know I'm going to be out of town when it happens, if it does.
No, I meant the idea of a referendum.
Here,
I meant
actually.
Marcella's idea of a referendum.
A referendum? I think that right now, if you look at the poll that was in the Globe today, a referendum would fail right now because it's really easy to be in favor of the Olympics right now, whether you're a resident of Massachusetts, whether you're a politician here, because there's no capital being expended. There's no political capital being expended by the by lawmakers or politicians. There's no financial capital that has anything to do with the public yet. I think that that this is going to be one of those things. Everything we're hearing right now is essentially from the International Olympic Committee starter kit. Mm-hmm. And you know, everybody says the same things. And it's going to be a question of details. But they're going to spend $70 to $100 million on making this bid in 2017. And I think that that's a commitment that's going to be hard for the city to walk away from. I think that essentially once you get to that point, it's difficult to pull back. I know in London, when they were halfway through the preparations for the Olympics, a majority of the people, as best I remember, said they'd rather give it to somebody else mm-hmm. than have it in London. And it cost London $20 billion. Yep. The average overrun is something like 252%. So this $4.5 billion estimate that Boston's put on it, it's not going to be anywhere near what it winds up costing. It probably costs $2 billion just for security.
Which is this is a point exactly the point that Andy Zimbalist made on our show earlier this week. Well, let's move on. In Washington, Senator Elizabeth Warren had a big win this week with the withdrawal of Treasury Department nominee Antonia Weiss. Now, Weiss is a Wall Street banker that Warren said was too close to the industry to have a job regulating it. She led the opposition. She went up against the White House on this, which had proposed Weiss for the job. So this was a win for Warren. And what do we think? I mean, John, what's your view on this? Is Warren more powerful as a senator than she might be as a presidential candidate, which people keep wanting to talk about, even though she says no, 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 no?
You know, can I just say unequivocally, Elizabeth Warren is not running for president. so that's one thing. It's really interesting that Elizabeth Warren did to Antonia Weiss what the Republicans did to Elizabeth Warren in 2010 when she was going to, when Barack Obama wanted her to be the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Yep. And he wound up with the same solution this time is he made Antonia Weiss a counselor to Treasury Secretary Jack Lew. So I think that that she has this ability to mobilize a certain segment of the Democratic Party. And I think that is where her power resides. If she went out and tried to extend that into other areas, I'm not sure she'd be as successful.
You mean as a candidate, for example,
right.
For president, right?
Exactly.
Marcella, what do you think? Do you think she's more powerful as a leader of the populist wing of the Democratic Party in this role as opposed to a candidate?
Perhaps, but she should be careful of precisely for what John was saying hurting her credibility. And the we actually wrote an editorial about this, how Antonia Weiss should deserve a vote, precisely because Elizabeth Warren in 2012 ran a campaign exactly opposed to this type of tactics that the Senate applied to her. You know, the holes, the filibusters, and all these other practices that essentially have contributed to, you know, being the Senate being called, you know, a completely useless body. And so for her to be doing the same thing right now, it just feels a little, hypocritical. And it may hurt her credibility. And for all these reasons, obviously, Wise deserved a vote. And if he indeed was not a good candidate, all this, he should have been given the opportunity to speak for himself.
Mm. All right. Well, let's move on. I want to talk about this story out of the University of Massachusetts, which said this week that it will end a confidential informant program in the wake of a deadly overdose by a student informant in 2013. So that student had agreed to help campus police in order to avoid drug charges. It was an arrangement that meant his parents were never informed of his drug use or about his cooperation with campus police. So here's Boston Globe reporter Scott Allen telling us about the story.
The night before Logan died, his mother talked to him on the phone. He was cheerful. He was looking forward to their visit. And he asked his mother, "Can you make some lasagna? I love your homemade lasagna. Can you bring that to me?"
So after the student died of a drug overdose at an off-campus apartment, the school launched a study of the informant program and concluded this week that the risks outweighed the benefits. So terrible story here. But I have to ask you both, because, you know, on the one hand, police use informants to keep drugs off of campus as much as possible. The report found that half of all drug arrests came from the informant program. On the other hand, it apparently prevented the kind of substance abuse intervention that could have saved this young man's life. Marcella, what's your take on this sad story and the way the University of Massachusetts has responded to it?
Oh, it was the right thing to do, for sure, to cancel the program. I was pleased to hear that. It's an incredibly problematic and risky policy, because we have to remember that campus police is not, presumably, not as sophisticated in training and handling confidential informants as any other law enforcement agencies. And having said that, these are students that they were dealing with, and so they totally put making drug arrests as a priority over Logan's health and well-being, not to mention the whole secrecy of the whole thing. So I was, and also that there was this pressure on the students to become informants, because you're essentially saying to them, you know, how about if you become an informant and then instead we won't notify your parents, and so right then and there that's the conflict. So I'm happy that it got canceled. It should have been canceled right away. It was suspended after the Globe reported this story, but now it's completely done.
John, do you expect this to influence the way other campuses around the country operate on this issue?
I would hope so. This practice is wrong all the way around the course. There's nothing right about this. And this is not the kind of life lesson that you should be getting in a college environment. It should be the opposite. The lesson should be there are consequences for things, and so and the consequences that you should pay directly the consequences for your actions, as opposed to it's what seems to have happened here is that Logan paid indirectly for the consequences of what he had done. So I think that this was an ill-advised policy from the start, and I'm hoping that I know there are no other public universities in Massachusetts that do it, according to the Globe. I'm hoping that there's nobody at all that does it, because I just think it's completely misguided.
I want to ask you both, and Marcella, you made reference to this, I'm going to ask you quickly about this because we're going to do more on this later this hour, but about yesterday's protests that shut down rush hour traffic along I-93 in Medford and in Milton, causing morning gridlock. 29 people were arrested. They chained themselves together to make human barricades, and they said they did it to protest police and state violence against Black people. This has prompted something of a debate about legitimate protest, just who these protests, who are not Black, who they were speaking for. And we're going to be talking about this later in the show. But I wanted to get a quick sort of thought from both of you in reaction to it. John, I'll come to you first.
Yeah, I thought it was funny that they used concrete, given that their objectives are so vague. I mean, you know, this is traditional Occupy stuff. Somebody said their chant should be, "What do we want? We don't know. When do we want it? Now." And I think that's very much the situation with this group. It's very muddy, and protests can be effective. I think this one was totally counterproductive, mostly because who knows what they're looking for.
Yeah. Marcella, your view on this?
Yeah, for me, it was just impressive on the logistical aspect. How did they manage to get themselves down there in the middle of I-93 at whatever time? That's in and of itself impressive. They may not have an end game, but they know how to, they obviously knew the logistics. You know, for me, it was totally the wrong way to raise the issue, for sure. But it worked. It worked, on one level.
You mean in terms of getting attention, it worked.
Totally, yeah. It may backfire because now there's legislation proposed to prohibit this type of protest, you know, to make a felony of anybody that disrupts traffic or chains themselves to a highway. But again, I think it worked on that level, whether, you know, on the legitimacy of someone of a different race speaking on behalf of somebody else. I think we should just not go there, period. Mm. And I think, again, it was not perhaps the wisest move, but I think it worked.
Well, we're going to be talking a lot more about this toward the end of this hour, so stay tuned for that, listeners. So, John and Marcella, we have just enough time left for our hubbubs, those stories that fell off the front page but perhaps caught your eye. John, let me come to you first. What's your hubbub?
My hubbub comes from BuzzFeed, the buzzy online publication, that ran a listicle this week with the headline, 31 Completely Normal Things Mitt Romney Did After Losing the Election. And apparently among the multitudinous daughters-in-law that Mitt Romney has, one of them is an active mommy blogger. And so Andrew Kaczynski, who is indefatigable in his efforts for BuzzFeed, compiled 31 of the things that he did. I'll just give you my favorite triptych. Number 7, he visited the city of Cusco in Peru. Number 8, he visited a charity clinic which performed eye surgeries. And number 9, he watched a cataract surgery. And the interesting thing is there are links to all these, but you can't read the blog unless you unless you're invited. So that's about as close as we're going to get.
All right, Marcella, top that one if you can.
God, I can't. I'm so sorry. I should have gone first. Mine is about Uber announcing a partnership with the city of Boston to share some of its ridership data. And I it is interesting on a few levels, but I come to this highly skeptical. I don't think this I'm just skeptical about how this is going to work, what the city of Boston can do with it, and whether it can translate into policy or not. It's limited data. It's about exactly in particular, it's about where and when people ride or use Uber in the city. We've heard a lot from Mayor Walsh about data and the use of data and blah, blah, blah. He even had a data dashboard in his office. But we still haven't really heard much about how access to data has informed some of his decisions. So what exactly is he looking in this data dashboard? And so this is just going to raise the same questions. And also, you know, Uber, of course, has been struggling and fighting with cities all over the country. And New York right now wants some of its data, and Uber hasn't really giving it to it. And so there's this inconsistency policy that Uber is applying. And so that really doesn't help the company either. So it's just interesting. Again, I'm highly skeptical, but we'll see what this yields.
Yeah, we will. We will indeed. It's an interesting story. We'll pay attention to that. Thanks for that. So my hubbub is about the potentially lucrative legal marijuana industry that might come to New England. And how that could become really attractive to states hoping to keep their books in balance. So Vermont is among the states where medical marijuana is legal, but Governor Peter Shumlin has said that he believes the state will follow Washington and Colorado into the world of full legalization. And this week, he got some interesting information about how that might work out for his state. According to a report from the RAND Corporation, Vermont could reap a whole lot of money, between $20 and $75 million a year on taxing legal marijuana. The report found that the higher figure could be reached with the help of marijuana tourism, folks coming from around the region to buy weed. It found that Vermont is surrounded by eager marijuana users, potential customers, if you will. But the report also warns that if other states get into the legal marijuana business, then Vermont won't make as much. But just a glimpse there at the potential legal marijuana economy coming soon to New England. John Carroll, professor of communications at Boston University and the man behind the Campaign Outsider blog. John, thank you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And Marcella Garcia, editorial page contributor at the Boston Globe. Marcella, great to have you. Have a great weekend and thank you.
Thank you. You too.
And listeners, stay with us. How bad is this year's flu season and what can you do to protect yourself? Questions and some answers about the flu. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.